Today is Friday, July 26, 1985, 1:30 p.m. in the Senate Finance Room in Juneau, Alaska. A couple of housekeeping measures. Senator Coghill.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, excerpts from the testimony before the grand jury witnesses Richard Peterson, Barry Brown, Greg Link, Gerald Richards, James Huell, Gordon Ewan, and Jeff Cook, presented by the counsel for the governor, I move for the record.
Any objections? So ordered.
Senator Chairman, Coghill. A memorandum dated July the 26, 1985, subject Department of Administration Purchasing Policy and Procedure, addressed to Senator Jan Fakes from Edward Hine Legislative Council, move that we submit to the record.
Any objections?
We have copies.
So ordered.
Yeah,
copies are being passed out. Would the clerk call the roll? Here.
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 Here. Let the record show that a quorum of the Rules Committee is here. For the information of all senators, on your desk should be a copy of an index of all documents that have been approved for distribution by the Rules Committee. Documents have been organized by their source. This is an initial listing only. If members of the Senate can identify other materials that have been distributed through the Rules Committee and should be on this list, please contact Mark Johnson of our committee staff. If the senator would like to obtain a copy of the document on the list, please tell the pages and identify the document by letter and number. These documents have been previously distributed to the press. I would remind you our agenda today is to complete the testimony of Anselm Stack, go into a discussion of questions about the grand jury process, and then to take testimony from Joseph Arsenault. With that, we will continue the questioning of Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Administration, Anselm Stack, by the Governor's Counsel, Mr. LaFavara. Senator Ray. I would remind Mr. Stack that he is still under oath for this committee.
I understand that, Mr. Chairman. Proceed, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. LaFavara.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Stock. Do you recall that yesterday when the proceedings adjourned, we were discussing Exhibit 14 contained in the bound volume of grand jury exhibits?
On which page?
That would be on page 37. Yes, indeed. Thank you. You recall that discussion?
Yes.
Let me begin by trying to explain where I would like to proceed with this line of examination. There was a bit of confusion, I think, between us as to whether I was trying to suggest that there was any knowledge that you should have had at the time that the October 5 memorandum, Exhibit 14, was prepared. But I want to clarify for the record that what I'm trying to bring out for the benefit of the members of the committee and the Senate is whether, in light of the accusation by the grand jury that brings us here today, that the process leading up to the Fairbanks office consolidation project somehow eliminated the benefit of competition from the state's interests, whether there is any substance to that accusation by the grand jury. In other words, the questions that I'm going to be putting to you are not designed to, in any way, cast any aspersions on you. Do you understand that?
Yes, I do.
The reason why I'll be asking these questions.
Yes.
We had addressed Exhibit 14, and the last line, if you would, on page 38, talks about how if certain conditions were observed, other than the two changes that we were discussing yesterday regarding boundaries and occupancy date, there could be an increase in competitive climate. You recall that
That is so stated on the memorandum.
Page 38. Thank you. But immediately prior to immediately following the sentence that we were just addressing on paragraph C, it says there's no vacant land in zones 3 or 4 which would make new construction unlikely. I take it that that means that new construction would be unlikely in zones 3 and 4 because there's no vacant land down there. Zones 3 and 4 are, if I'm correct, the downtown core area. If you need to refer to the exhibit maps, please do so.
That zones 3 and 4 were encompassed the one that we eventually used to negotiate from in the smaller zone that was originally requested.
That's correct. Is it your understanding that Zone 3, which is the one that was ultimately used, was defined by the Fairbanks Development Authority as a priority area for development in the core area?
That was my understanding.
And if you look at Exhibit 17 on page 41, I believe it is so described there. Yes, that's correct. So the memorandum that we have been discussing, Exhibit 14, concludes that there would be no vacant land on which to construct any new buildings in the zone that was ultimately used, the core area of the Fairbanks Development Authority.
Yes.
So occupancy date could have no effect on that.
That is the way one can read it, yes.
Do you have a different reading of it?
No, not at this time.
Thank you. Let's then turn to the question of the boundaries themselves. And I refer you back to page 37 of Exhibit 14. The indented paragraphs, the first one is Zone 1. And the memorandum from Mr. Peterson states, this zone would provide two responses to the invitation to bid if the occupancy date remains fixed at July 1. Zone 1, am I correct, was the original draft of the boundaries?
Yes.
In order to ascertain whether or not that memorandum, which suggests that if the original zone had been used, there would have been at least one additional bidder, I'd like to direct your attention to some aspects of the testimony before the grand jury report was prepared, indicating that the result of the process that's at issue somehow deprived the state of the benefits of competition. Mr. Stock, have I provided to you, not very long ago, a series of excerpts of pages from the testimony of certain witnesses, Mr. Peterson, Mr. Brown, Mr. Link, and others?
Yes, you provided that to me about an hour ago.
Yes, sir. And I appreciate that you may not have had a chance to digest these. And for the record, I am referring to the excerpts that I believe have been, with the chairman's permission, now distributed to all members of the committee. Your testimony, I believe, is that this memorandum, Exhibit 14, was prepared at your request by Mr. Peterson.
Yes.
To ascertain what the effect would be of changing the boundaries and occupancy date or not changing them.
Yes.
And he concluded that there would be two bids if the original zone were kept.
Yes.
All right. Let's take a look, if we may, about how that process worked. I think it's important for the committee to understand what substance, if any, there is behind that seemingly important statement. Direct your attention first to page 647 of the grand jury transcript. And for members of the committee, all of these are included in the excerpts that have been distributed. Mr. Peterson is asked about the preparation of Exhibit 14. And on lines 7 and 8, says, this is a result of a telephone survey that we were asked to perform on possible locations for a leased facility in Fairbanks. That's your understanding of how this document was prepared. Is that correct?
My understanding of how the document was prepared was that I asked for a survey to be conducted. I did not, to my memory, specify how it was to be conducted and how in-depth it was to be done.
Thank you. Would you turn, please, to the bottom of page 648, still Mr. Peterson testifying. He's asked a question about Exhibit 14. Your memorandum indicates they would provide two responses if the original zone was used. Yes, there was empty land in there, and if someone wanted to pick up an option on it, they could have done so. A lot of that land is presently being used for parking, and it'd be expensive land, but I think it could have been obtained. But there were two that were sure bets at bidding on it. Close quote. That's Mr. Peterson's testimony. Reading down lower on page 49, he is asked by the prosecutor, what were those two, the sure bets that he's describing? Answer on line 16. The Fifth Avenue Center, the building that ultimately received the lease, and one that was proposed by Mr. Barry Brown, I believe the name was, which was two blocks east of the zone set forth in 3, but would have been within the original zone. Is that correct?
Just for the record, I've read this once, about an hour ago. As with most transcripts, you have to read it several times to really understand it. And to the degree that you read the sentence in this form, that's simply what it says. Whether or not it's in context or not, one would have to read further.
I understand. I think the members of the Senate and certainly Chief Counsel will bring out either during your testimony or otherwise whether this testimony is out of context. Turning then to the testimony of Mr. Barry Brown, who was also called before the grand jury, I'd ask you to turn to page 1313. See on lines 11 and 12, he's asked the question, October of which year? This is referring to a telephone call from Mr. Peterson. You had a telephone conversation with Mr. Peterson during that month. Line 21, answer. He was inquiring as to the availability of 20,000 square foot of office space in Fairbanks. Question. And you say you did some research and then called him back. Answer. Yes. I won't go through all of the testimony on the next page with you, Mr. Peterson, but you'll see line 11. Do you recall which developers you contacted? Answer. 12, line 12. Greg Link. He is also a broker. Turn to page 1317. Beginning at line 8, the testimony reads, this is testimony of Mr. Brown, question, the purpose that you had in initiating that conversation was what? To offer the state a potential site. Line 20, he states in answer to who's we, quote, I'm speaking in terms of the developer Greg Link, close quote. Page 13, when he's asked about the building that he was going to offer to the state. Line 2, the answer from Mr. Brown. Let me explain. The property that, the hole in the ground as it is now, was part of a parcel owned by Jerry Sadler of Sadco Associate Industries. Excuse me. Mr. Link planned to build a building, maybe not last year, but sometime in the near future, on that site. In preparation for that, they dug a hole out in October, and we could have started the foundation at any time. Then turning to page 1321, he's asked about how long it would have taken to get that building built for the state. Answer, line 4, quote, it was fairly impractical to expect the state to do what would have been necessary for us to start in the middle of winter, but the hope was there that within a month from the date of that letter, we could have a commitment from the state that our site would be used. End of the quote on that line. Line 17, and you could have been up and completed by mid-July of 1985. Answer, that's what Mr. Link told me. Now let's turn to Mr. Link's testimony, Mr. Stock, to see what he says about whether he was the sure bet that Mr. Peterson's testimony reported and that his memorandum seems to assert. Page 1400, Mr. Link, the witness before the grand jury, which reported that this process deprived the state of competition. He's asked how he first became aware of the state's interest in consolidation. Line 11 is the answer. I believe it was from Barry Brown, who had Alaska Realty at the time, and called me and asked if I knew of any space available, buildings available, land available, or if I was interested at all myself in providing the space.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to
inquire to the chair whether Mr. Lacovara has a question. He is reading testimony. He's making an argument. I'd like to inquire whether he has a question.
May I respond?
Mr. Lacovara?
Yes. The question that I'm going to put, of course, requires that the witness understand the premises of my hypothetical question. I'm trying to lay the foundation for a hypothetical question.
I'm trying to understand it, too, so please continue.
Well, let me tell you what the hypothetical is so that you can understand the context of this. The hypothetical is, and this is what I was asking about last night, if it were in fact the case that the only other potential bidder had said that under no circumstances did he have a serious interest in bidding on this site, even if the original zone had been kept, would that, in your judgment, be consistent with the memorandum prepared by Mr. Peterson, Exhibit 14, in which he stated this zone would provide two responses?
If it was known at the time, if it was known at the time that it really would not have been a response that could be counted on, then the memorandum itself would be an error.
Thank you. Let me then, as the last point of reference to fill out the hypothetical question, Mr. Stock, refer you simply to page 1421 of Mr. Link's testimony. The grand juror asks him, I think the grand juror understood where this testimony went, but that's up to the Senate to decide. I guess my question is then, you did not particularly follow up on the indication of a state's interest in the 30,000. Answer, no, I did not. Grand juror, why not? Because I'd been through it for about a year with the United Bank Alaska, that was another building, and I didn't feel like doing it. Grand juror, what would it have taken for you to have seriously followed up on that? I mean, what? Answer, oh, I don't think I would have myself. I don't think I would have seriously at that time done it. End quote. Now, I put to you hypothetically, Mr. Stock, assuming that this testimony fairly states the interest or lack of interest in the only other potential bidder identified as a result of Mr. Peterson's survey, does that expression of interest rise to the level of conforming with Exhibit 14 that, quote, this zone would provide two responses to the invitation to bid if the occupancy date remains fixed at July 1?
From one reading of it, this brief discussion, and from the hypothetical question that you've asked, and summarizing it under these conditions, my answer would be is that you've called into question whether or not, you know, this particular document is correct. And it would appear that, you know, that could possibly be the case from that bit of testimony. Whether or not there is other testimony in the record that would refute that, or additional testimony, I don't know. But that particular testimony would seem to refute the statement in here that that's the only, that there is a second source of competition. Whether or not that is germane to the question of how this process started and ended up is a different matter.
I agree. Those are two separate questions. All I was trying to demonstrate, all I was trying to address, was whether or not there was an impact from the process. Well, let's turn to a different subject. I don't want to linger on this. There's been some reference to the concept of bid rigging. Indeed, it's in the same memorandum that we've been discussing, Exhibit 14. In the indented paragraph on page 37, labeled Zone 3, Mr. Peterson states, I believe, that if one went to a competitive bid when there was only one likely response, that would have the appearance of bid rigging. Correct?
Yes.
And that was a concern of yours as well as other people.
Yes.
You raised that concern with, among other people, John Shively. Is that correct?
Yes.
When you used the term bid rigging, you were not, I assume, talking about any kind of conspiracy to do anything illegal, in the antitrust sense, for example.
I don't believe so.
The concept as you were using it, and as it's used in these memorandums to the extent you understood them, was that if there's only going to be one bidder, you should go sole source
and not by competitive process.
That was the concept and that was the intent. The description was that the process would wind up with only one bidder, and therefore the question really relates to the two parts of also whether or not it relates to excluding other competition. But it does relate to whether or not we should go to sole source.
Right. And you testified yesterday, I believe, that at the meeting with Commissioner Rudd in June of 1984, she said the governor's office wanted this to go sole source.
She said that. Now, whether that particular incident and this particular point we're at now, after having prepared in the intervening time a draft RFP, are connected, they're not necessarily so.
All right, let's get to the ultimate outcome. Let me see if I understand the testimony correctly. You raised some concerns with John Shively about using an RFP rather than a sole source negotiation, if it could be justified, because it would seem like bid rigging. And Mr. Shively, or you, referred the matter to the Attorney General's office. Is that correct?
The matter was referred to the Attorney General's office prior to the time that the market survey was conducted, as I remember.
And what was the Attorney General's recommendation, to your knowledge?
To my knowledge at the time, the recommendation was they were going to take the information forward and discuss it with Norman Gorsuch.
And do you know what happened as a result of that process?
I don't know what specifically happened as a result of that process. If my memory serves me correctly, they did not seem to have a concern with the process proceeding at the time. At least they didn't report back that there was a problem with the process proceeding.
At some time during October, am I correct, it was requested that the Department of Administration prepare the necessary analysis for a sole source negotiation. Is that correct?
In October, it was discussed that we had turned, that during a meeting, we turned the information over to John Shively. I think the actual discussions as to when the bid waiver was created was during early November.
Yes, that would be Exhibit 19 on page 43, for example. Memorandum dated 10-19-1984, which appears to have been passed along at your request, in which sentences contain, a bid waiver does not seem inappropriate given the constraints. And then later on, Exhibit 20 on the next page, the bid waiver request was prepared and approved by the relevant officials.
Yes.
Did you, Mr. Stock, concur that given the constraints that have been imposed with respect to boundary and occupancy date, that a sole source contract satisfied the statutory standard that that kind of procurement was in the, quote, best interest of the state, close quote?
Yes. Prefaced with, given the constraints, that a bid waiver was appropriate.
Thank you. I'd like to turn now to the other insinuation of misconduct on the part of the governor's office. And we're using the same distinction that I believe we tried to establish last night. Governor's office, presumably meaning John Shively and not the governor personally. And to the extent any of the questions that I may ask, I call for you to change your testimony that you had no personal dealings with the governor on this subject. Please correct me if I'm in error that when we're speaking about the governor's office, we're talking about Mr. Shively or somebody other than the governor. Is that a fair request? Do you understand the request?
I understand the request in the terms that my contact during the situation was with John Shively. And so, therefore, if I apply the term governor's office, it only applies specifically to him.
Yesterday, during the examination by the deputy chief counsel of the Senate, I believe there were two types of improper interference during the negotiation process that were explored with you. And let me see if I'm summarizing them correctly. One was Mr. Shively's allegedly improper intervention to move up the commencement date of the negotiations. Is that one of the subjects that you recall?
Those are one of the subjects.
And the second was the alleged leaking of bidding information concerning the Anchorage, the frontier building negotiation in Anchorage, in a way that was allegedly undermining the negotiation of the price for this project. Is that the second major alleged impropriety?
As I remember, that's a summary of it, the compromising of the negotiations. is what I would put it in a broader sense.
Were there any other specifics that would fit under the umbrella of compromising the negotiations other than these two?
As I remember it, it was really those two in terms of pushing the negotiations along at a faster pace than was intended, and compromising the negotiations with inside information.
Thank you. All right. Turning first to the pace question. You have seen a memorandum, I understand, and it was discussed yesterday, in which some of your subordinates complained that the directive that they begin to negotiate on December 26th compromised their strategy of trying to string this out in order to achieve an advantage by reason of delay. Do you recall that?
To my memory, I did not see that memorandum at that time. I was aware of a discussion that Bruce Moore and I had, if my memory serves me correctly, as to the fact that he had complained that there were that the negotiations were being compromised.
All right. When you had the discussion, was it with Mr. Moore in which you conveyed the request or instruction that the negotiators meet on December 26th? Did he say that they had a strategy of trying to delay?
As I remember, no.
What was his statement explaining why they didn't want to meet that soon?
As I remember it, he, the first thing he did was just say, I'll find out what's going on. And he left and found out what was going on. I think we had some discussion over, both of us had already recognized that there was a fair level of interest at the, quote, governor's office level, and that it is somewhat unusual that the chief of staff will show a personal interest in a project to that degree, and therefore, let's see what we can do about getting an earlier meeting, you know, just meet with them.
And did they express, through Mr. Moore or otherwise, reluctance to meet?
As I remember, he reported back to me that they were going to be able to meet on December the 26th.
But am I correct that they expressed a reluctance to meet because they were involved in other projects that they were negotiating?
Bruce may have mentioned, I don't know, I can't remember with the certainty, but he may have mentioned that there are other projects you're going to meet on, and that certainly could have been the case because we had four other projects going on at the same time, which were amounted to about a good 500,000 square feet versus this 32,000 square feet. So we were a little bit busy at the time.
Right. Well, let me ask the question directly then. Did anyone report back to you that the request to meet on December 26th would undermine the state's strategy for this negotiation?
To my memory, no.
The sole source negotiation approval was signed on, that's Exhibit 20, signed on November 13th. Does that sound correct?
Yes.
And your understanding was that the state negotiators did not want to have the first negotiation on this until sometime after the first of the year?
My understanding at the time, after I signed this, I left it up to them as to what they were going to do.
I meant as of the time Mr. Shively asked you to try to move up the negotiation session, at that time the negotiator said they didn't want to meet until after the first of the year.
Yes.
Let's turn to the second major impropriety that seems to have been alleged. Turn to Exhibit 39, if you would, please. On page 54 of the grand jury exhibits. You seen this document before?
I have seen it since this investigation has started.
Do you recall being asked questions about it yesterday?
Yes.
Is it fair to say that this document complains that there had been a leak about the negotiation of the Frontier building in Alaska, and that that leak was undermining the state's negotiations with respect to the Fifth Avenue Center?
Yes.
Is it your understanding that the implication is that someone
either in the governor's office or above you in the Department of Administration was responsible for that leak?
I think, if I remember correctly, at the time, the inference was that that information was being leaked by some form of outside source to them.
Outside of what?
Well, the fact that the information was being transmitted from inside information and somehow getting over to them. Bruce, I think, and I also discussed at the time, because he was the one that brought one of the complaints forward. This does not specifically relate to the memo alone. There's a more personal discussion that went on. We did have a discussion that there might be several avenues through which that information might get across to them.
Including perhaps disclosure by Department of Administration negotiators.
That was never an assumption on our part.
Since that time, Mr. Stock, have you had occasion to review testimony of Mr. Richards, Mr. Hoodle, and Mr. Unwin, and Mr. Cook, contained in the excerpts distributed to the committee today?
Yes, that was part of the documentation you supplied to me prior to the meeting.
Do you feel comfortable summarizing the testimony of the negotiators for the Fifth Avenue Center as to where they obtained the information about the Anchorage lease negotiations?
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman, I wonder if that's a proper question to ask the witness. Their testimony speaks for itself. I'm not sure he should be asked to testify.
Let me ask a hypothetical question, Mr. Chairman. Hypothetical question. If the testimony contained in the excerpts that has been distributed, testimony presented to the grand jury from all of the negotiators involved in negotiating with Mr. Peterson of the Department of Administration said that they got this information about the Frontier lease directly from Mr. Peterson in the ordinary course of those negotiations, would that seem to you inconsistent with the assertion that this information must have been leaked from, as you put it, someone outside the Department of Administration?
In that context, it would be inconsistent.
Thank you. My final area of discussion with you concerns the reasonableness of the lease price. You testified about Exhibit 3 yesterday. Page 12 and 13. You were, if I remember correctly, examined extensively on the subject of the lease negotiations leading up to a $2.39 price. Is that correct?
Can I ask again where?
Yes, Exhibit 3, pages 12 and 13 of the grand jury exhibit binder.
That's the memorandum of December 1?
Yes.
Okay.
Do you recall seeing this document?
Yes.
Turn to page 13, if you would, please. Read the first sentence of the first full paragraph.
Price, assuming construction during the 1984 season, would approximate $3 per square foot rent.
Thank you. Did this indicate that as of December 1st, 1983, the state thought that it might be paying $3 a square foot for lease for space constructed or leased in the Fairbanks area?
It indicated that an assumption was that we could pay up to $3 a square foot.
I'd like to jump right ahead now to Exhibit 21, about which you were also examined yesterday. You were asked whether this was a summary of the actual negotiations in this matter. Do you recall that? This is on page 46.
Yes.
Does it indicate to you that the state's opening bid was $2 a square foot?
Yes.
And the owner's opening bid was $2.82 per square foot?
Yes.
And if you turn to the second page, that would be page 47. Was it your understanding, and is it your understanding, that the owners had made six offers?
Yes.
And the state's offer was still $2 a square foot?
It had eventually changed on the sixth offer to a, as I understood, the state's final offer moved above the $2 per square foot.
So in response to five offers from the owners, which according to page 46 had their price dropping from $2.82, the state didn't budge a penny.
No, we like to drive a hard bargain.
And so you should. Exhibit 23, about which you were also asked yesterday, page 48-49, this contains your recommendation that the owner's $2.39 offer should be adopted rather than having the state break off the negotiations because it's the state's proposal of $2.30 would not be accepted. Do you recall testifying about this?
Yes.
Do you recall the memorandum and the analysis that went into it?
Yes.
The difference at the time seemed like 4%. On a per square foot basis?
On a per square foot basis, the difference based upon the analysis was, I don't have the exact calculation, but between 230 and 239, that seems about reasonable.
And you were familiar, I take it at the time, with the exhibit, that's page 50 to that document, which showed that under one set of assumptions, the owner's offer would actually cost the state less than the state negotiator's offer. Is that correct?
That was a set of assumptions, yes.
Now, the grand jury report contained what I think can fairly be characterized as some criticism of this analysis. Are you familiar with that?
Yes, I am.
Did you attempt to explain to the prosecutors in any way why their analysis might not be sound and yours might be? You're a CPA, are you not?
Yes.
And you have a degree in business administration?
Yes.
Thank you. Did you attempt to explain that your figures might be more reliable than theirs?
Yes, I attempted to explain to them that after we went through a discussion of how we normally adjust leases, determined on a percentage of the consumer price index, and that under certain circumstances, even if you, let's say, here there was an adjustment factor of using 4% CPI increase. Now, that 4% increase says CPI behind it, but when I took a look at that, I know that that you can have an increase that is made of two components, a component based upon the consumer price interest and another component based upon the market adjustment that might take place during the period of time. Similar type of adjustment that takes place where the value of a house goes up as inflation goes up. You don't keep the same value on the baseline of the house. That there were several different methods that could be used, and that when you take a total 4% adjustment factor, that's really two components. We then had a discussion about the fact, well, if you use a 6% CPI factor only, then you should really only adjust these two schedules by 2%. My explanation to the prosecutors at the time was that you're ignoring the market factor. What interchanged after that point was a rather heated discussion between the prosecutors and myself, and the summation of that discussion was that I was to answer only the questions that they were to put to me, and that this substance of the discussion was ended.
Do you believe to this day that your judgment is more accurate about the economics than the prosecutor's?
I definitely think so.
Thank you. I'd like to turn now, Mr. Stock, to what I'm sure we're all glad will be my final two or three questions. The final allegations about pressure from the governor's office concerned the actual execution of the lease after all the terms had been agreed upon through the negotiations. Are you familiar with that incident? You were asked about it yesterday, if I'm correct.
You'll have to refresh my memory as to exactly what the allegations were.
The allegations were, as I believe you were asked yesterday, that there was a complaint that the refinancing for this project was in jeopardy because the owners did not yet have a signed lease, and the governor's office, presumably Mr. Shively, asked that the state turn to executing the lease as soon as possible.
Yes, there was a conversation, as I remember, in early February in early February of this year, that indicated that John Shively and I had talked, and he wanted to know when were we going to get the lease signed, and that the owners had some refinancing to do.
Is there any state interest that you could point to in not signing a lease or in delaying signing a lease once the terms have been agreed to?
I was not aware of any specific interest in either signing it or not signing it in an expeditious manner. I mean, as far as I was concerned, that's up to them. But I think I must reiterate, as I have before, and it's not simply a complaint, I think the staff members had an awful lot of other work to do. And they may have just not had time to get around to it.
Right, but it is not your understanding that there was some specific desire to delay signing this lease in order to advance some state interest. Is that correct?
As my memory serves me correctly, I didn't understand of any.
Right. Well, let me turn it around and put it in a way that I think may be more pertinent. Could the state's interests actually have been injured if, as a result of the delay, the refinancing had fallen through and the building had been foreclosed upon by the bank?
Is that as a hypothetical question?
Yes.
If we had negotiated an offer that we felt was reasonable at the time, then if that offer fell through, that would be detrimental to our position.
And you'd have to start all over again with the bank or with someone else?
Yes.
Am I correct, Mr. Stock, that you concluded your testimony yesterday by saying that you thought that the outcome of this process, putting aside how the process worked, but the outcome of the process led to the states achieving a fair price for the space it needed?
Let it be said that way. I believe that the outcome was a fair price given the constraints. And that's the most important point. If you compare the price that we got, it is, in my view, I believe that our negotiators drove a hard bargain. I believe that Mr. Peterson and Mr. Jackson did a good job in holding to their position. I believe that, they negotiated in good faith. I was concerned about the fact that I believe that there was some compromise in the negotiating process. There's very little question about that, in my mind. Given those constraints, and if you make a comparison, you come out with something that's very close, either over or under. The point is, no one will ever know, realistically, whether or not a competitive bid would have produced a different value.
Or whether there could have been a competitive bid.
Yes.
Right. You just mentioned, Mr. Stock, that you were concerned about interference or undermining in the negotiation process. Are those the incidents we've just discussed of moving ahead the negotiation process and the alleged leak of the Frontier building lease terms? Or is there something else? I just need to ask you to clarify that for me.
No, in terms of compromising the negotiation process was the fact is more related to whether or not information was being transmitted forward from the state side, the information as to negotiations. And as far as I was concerned, any parts of the owner's offers. Because these negotiation sheets, as I remember, were available to more than one individual. To myself, as I remember, to Commissioner Rudd, and also may have been available to John Shively.
And on that question, it is relevant for the Senate to determine whether the leak of that information, in fact, came from Mr. Peterson. Would you agree with that statement?
That is someone else's estimation to make.
Yes, thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Stock, and thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Prior to moving on to the Senate portion of the questioning, Mr. Jim Hamilton, Deputy Counsel for the Senate, is asked to make a short statement regarding his questioning of Mr. Stack yesterday.
Mr. Chairman, because of certain statements and comments made to me regarding Mr. Stack's testimony about a meeting with Ms. Rudd on yesterday, I think, in fairness to Ms. Rudd and to Mr. Cook, who was mentioned, it's appropriate for me to read certain statements from Ms. Rudd into the record. By way of background, Mr. Stack testified yesterday that in a June 19th meeting with Miss Rudd. Miss Rudd said to him that there were pressures on her to go sole source with the Fairbanks office lease and use Jeff Cook's building. And then Miss Rudd said, according to Mr. Stack, that this was a political payoff. The comment was made to me, of course, accurately, that it's unfortunate that Mrs. Rudd is no longer here to respond. I thought that this testimony was relevant because it showed Mr. Stock's state of mind and it showed why he acted as he did. In a court of law, of course, his statement would not go to the truth of Ms. Rudd's statements. But I think a court likely would allow its admissibility to show the effect of Mr. Stock. So the hearsay rule will not be applicable. Nonetheless, I think, in fairness, as I said to Ms. Rudd and Mr. Cook, I should take a few minutes here and read into the record certain testimony by Ms. Rudd that goes to this matter. First of all, I'm reading from Ms. Rudd's statement on 41585, unsworn statement to prosecutors at the Department of Law, and I'm reading from page 50. Question, do you recall telling anyone that the lease was going to be a payoff to Jeff Cook for political reasons? Answer, I don't think I ever would have used those terms because I didn't know what the reason was. Question, is it inconceivable that you used those terms? Answer, I would doubt that I would have used those terms, but I might have. I just don't know. It's not characteristic of me to talk like that. Now I would like to read certain passages from Ms. Rudd's transcript before the grand jury. I should point out that she starts discussing Mr. Cook on page 529, and it goes on for about 10 pages. I'm not going to read all of that. I'm going to read certain selected portions. I'm sure members of the Senate can read the rest of it, and if they think I've left something out that's important, it can be brought out. On page 531, question, do you recall having any conversation with Mr. Shively concerning Mr. Cook? Answer, there was one meeting wherein there was, as I say, a great deal of pressure to proceed with a space study and get things moving and get things done. Question, this was a meeting that took place where? Answer, in the governor's office. Question, in the governor's own personal office or in the general governor's office? Answer, in the governor's personal office. Question, okay, and who was present? Answer, the governor was there, and John Shively was there, and I was there, and I think Anselm might have been there also. I can't recall, but I think he was. And Mr. Chairman, I'm now skipping to page 533, line 4. Question, how do you recall the subject coming up during that meeting? Answer, I don't recall how it came up. My recollection, I'll just give you my recollection of it, was that I was feeling a lot of pressure and interest in getting moving on this project, and at some point I said, I'm getting the impression that you would like to have this work go to Jeff Cook, and the answer to that was in the affirmative. Who was that statement directed at? That was the question. Answer, I really can't recall whether it was the governor or John. I would assume, well, I really don't know, but at any rate, they were both there. Question, when you say that you had been feeling a degree of pressure that caused you to make that statement, was it pressure that originated with that meeting, or did you have in mind things that preceded that particular meeting? Answer, I think when I asked that question, I was thinking of the whole cumulative process that we've been going through for about 6 months. Now, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to switch to page 535, and I will begin reading at line 23, and I will continue to the next page. Question, and this pressure also was coming from the governor's office? Answer, yes, yes. Question, from Mr. Shively? Answer, yes. Question, from the governor also? Answer, I don't recall receiving pressure directly from the governor on that. And so, at that time, during that conversation, what I was trying to do was preserve the space study as a viable study and to allow the completion of it in an orderly way so that it would be really useful to the state. And so I said, you know, we may end up in that building, but we have to have a process, and it has to justify the use of that building, and it has to be a process the same as such we use for other acquisitions. Question, was there any response to that statement on your part? Answer, I would say it was sort of an impatient affirmation. Yeah, yeah, go ahead and do what you have to do, but keep it on track and keep it going. Question, did you ask Mr. Shively or the governor to to your recollection why it was that whichever of them had indicated in the affirmative wanted this lease to go to Jeff Cook's building. Answer, no. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I think counsel did not read page 49 of the statement, and if I may, this is counsel. I find that page 49, Commissioner Rudd saying this, the only thing I know is that Jeff Cook and John Shively served in the board of these together, University Regions together, yeah. So I assume they were friends, and that's about as far as I went. Question, had you ever heard of anything about Cook being involved in the fundraising activity? No, I don't recall that.
Okay, let's move on then to the Senate portion of the questioning of Mr. Stack, Senator Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First, I think if you're leave, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to straighten up a couple of things in my mind, at least to help Mr. Hamilton, who should know that you always get into trouble when you try to plagiarize somebody else. And in this respect, from the testimony of Mr. Pack yesterday, he asked him, Mr. Stack, I hate to plagiarize questions from other people, but I would like to ask you on a scale of 1 to 10, what was the degree of interest of the governor's office in this project, 10 being the greatest and 1 being the lowest? And I would like for you to base your answer on your experience as to the governor's office interest in other projects. The answer, of course, is 9.5. Now, Mr. Stack, the inference that I made when I questioned Ms. Herman was not other building projects or leasing projects, was projects such that had to do with the governor's office, such as the forthcoming budget, revenue projects, transfer of the Alaska Railroad. Now, putting the lease of the Fairbanks building in that perspective, what would you say it was on a range of 1 to 10?
Senator Ray, first of all work that is conducted in the office comes through, a lot of it is based upon the context you have with the commissioner, chief of staff, or an executive assistant, or the governor himself. My answer, as it relates to that, is based upon the number of times I wind up getting contacted by the chief of staff on any project, and also how many times I wind up getting contacted by the commissioner on a project.
What I take it to be your answer is projects relating strictly to your business of leasing and not to the overall business of the state. Maybe I should say on a range of 1 to 10, how would you rate your duties and responsibilities to the state with the governors on a range of 1 to 10?
I think that they're somewhat smaller. But at the same time, and it needs an answer to the question, is that You are asking me, in the area of my purview, how did this project rate in terms of pressure on us versus other projects? And also recognizing the fact...
That isn't my question at all, Mr. Stack.
Well, then why don't you clarify your question?
If I may, I'd be more than happy to. And please don't consider me in an adversarial position, because I'm not any more than... but I'm trying to be... might be interesting, and it might be amusing to some of the people here, but it is amusing to me. I don't say anything funny about it. What I'm trying to do is get the relationship down. We know what your business is. You're in the business of leasing, and that's very important to you. And possibly the leasing of the Fairbanks building at that particular time was a 9.5. But what my inference was, and what Mr. Hamilton was trying to get across, was in what relationship the Fairbanks building lease was in the overall consideration of the business of the state. My
answer of 9.5 was based upon those areas under my control only.
Under your control only. Thank you very much. Now, there was quite a bit of questioning yesterday between you and Mr. Hamilton, and I think Mr. Lacavera touched on about who gave away the information on the Frontier building. Now, did you read the transcripts of the grand jury?
I only read very briefly the portions that were provided to me by Mr. Lacavera. I have not had a chance to do very much extensive reading on my own testimony since I was only able to obtain that 2 to 3 days ago. And I haven't read anybody else's testimony other than that.
Well, in the, to help you along, in the transcript of Mr. Jeff Cook is in his testimony on page 1117. They talk about grand jury exhibit number 50, which is a letter from Jerry Richards to, from Mr. What's his name here? I can't remember what this guy's name is. Cook, Jeff Cook. There's a letter from Jeff Cook to Jerry Richards in which they say he stated that the question was, now in this letter you state that the price that the state is currently negotiating for the Frontier Building in Anchorage is $2.35 a square foot. Answer, correct. And the question, where did you get that information? And the answer from Mr. Cook, in the negotiating session a number of times, Mr. Peterson, the state negotiator, indicated that he knew he was in the middle of the Frontier negotiations. And the topic kept coming up. And I believe it was myself in the negotiating session with all the parties present asked Mr. Peterson, is it permissible for you to tell us what rate you're negotiating here in Anchorage on the Frontier Building? And then down here he says, and he gave us that information and I took it down and I took notes during all the sessions. So perhaps that will help Mr. Hamilton if he didn't get the correct answer to yourself. Now, if I could just get to a couple other questions here, Mr. Stack. Did you consider appearing here in front of this group with an attorney? Did you consider that?
Senator Ray, no, I have never considered that. I, during this entire process, in my discussion with both prosecutors and my time for a grand jury and coming here, at no time have I have considered it to the degree that the thought went through my mind at one time or another. I did not believe that it was necessary.
Well, the only reason I asked you that was because some of the testimony that's, and some of the information that's appeared in the media was that some of your subordinates were of such a mind and so fearful that something was happening during these proceedings that they were alleged to have contacted private attorneys. Did you ever contact a private attorney and ask him whether you were doing right or wrong?
I did not contact a private attorney. I did have discussions with state's counsel, being the attorney general.
I said private attorney outside the state. You didn't do that. You didn't fear for your life, so to speak, in the rest of it.
No, but I must expand upon that, Senator Ray, because I basically had checked out, what I believe to be checked out, some of my actions with the state's attorney general's office. But there were obviously other things as went on. I was not as concerned because of the level that I was at and the assurances that I believe I had up to that point in time.
Okay. Were you in relation to the statement by Ms. Rudd that, you say that she said and she says she don't remember testimony, were you aware of a strained relationship between Governor Sheffield and Commissioner Rudd?
I would answer that with saying that I was not specifically aware of a strained relationship. I am since aware of a strained relationship, not first based upon the testimony that I have read in a newspaper, but based upon a personal conversation between Commissioner Rudd and myself.
And you and her were more or less a confidant. You were personal friends besides being working socially. I mean, you talked about other people and other conditions.
Yes.
But in your mind, her statement wasn't just off the top. Having come back from the governor's office and one of the trips and through frustration say, well, it's a political payoff and nothing like that happened. This was a concerted effort upon her to relay certain information to you as to the character of the negotiations that were going on. Is that what your statement was? That's what you indicate to me, and I want to know if that's true.
Her statements made to me were just, in terms of how they were put on, were simply a matter of a fact kind of thing. And the statements were simply said, I guess I don't know how to describe that better other than just very straightforward. As a matter of fact kind of thing, it wasn't excited or animated, how sometimes I get, let's say.
Well, could you just could you tell us then why you think that she recanted and said that she didn't see it?
Senator Ray, I am not going to speculate on that. I believe that's inappropriate for me to speculate on.
But you felt it was appropriate to relay what she had said, even though she wasn't here to account for it.
I felt that that was appropriate after my discussions with Mr. Hamilton, and after my discussions, knowing that that information had been previously passed on to the Attorney General's office, which was aware of it, and that it was relevant to this particular investigation.
Was there some confusion between your people and the governor's office about competitive bids and so forth? Was there ever a confusion there? What I mean is, were your people talking competitive bid while Mr. Shively had already changed the sole source?
My understanding is that, as far as I were concerned, we were in tune. At least that's the way we interpreted. We were going with a competitive bid up to a certain point in time. We got additional information, and we wound up with a sole source. I thought that they understood that.
Well, that was from reading from the transcript. I got the other impression. I got the impression that somehow your people were behind the curve, so to speak, and were still talking competitive bid when Mr. Shively said he already knew that there was no such thing as bid rigging because it couldn't go to anything but its sole source, in his estimation.
The information that was transmitted to John Shively in terms of the market survey was done around October the 19th. Up until that point in time, even on September the 25th, when he approved a copy of the draft RFP, we were still talking about a bid. We were talking about a bid on October 2nd, when the particular boundary was outlined and given to me. During the time frame between October the 5th, when the market survey was done, and October 19th, it was my understanding that Mr. Shively did not know the results of that market survey. As far as I understand, the conversion to a bid waiver happened during late October, beginning November of 1984.
How many meetings are you aware of that took place about the Fifth Avenue project between your office and the AG's office?
I don't have a specific recollection as to exactly how many. There may have been more than two.
And were you present along with members of the AG's office and members of the governor's staff at any meetings that questioned the propriety of the leasing procedures of the Fifth Avenue building? Remember what I said. Members of the AG's office and members of the governor's staff were in questions about the propriety of the leasing procedures of the Fifth Avenue building.
To answer your question, if I understand it, where the three parties are involved, governor's staff, AG's office, and ourselves, the answer would be no.
Okay. Were you present with any, you were present at the two meetings where, with the AG's staff, wherein the procedures were discussed?
You
personally, were you in any of these meetings?
I was personally present in terms of transmitting the information and the maps at the time, as I remember, in terms of transmitting the information to the Attorney General's office.
Did you question the propriety of the actions at that time?
At that time, the reason I took it over there was to get their assessment of the situation.
That isn't what I asked you. I said, did you question it?
I would have to say that in my mind, I was questioning part of the propriety of the action, and that's why I was going over there.
But did you ask them, is this proper?
I think, to my recollection, I did.
Now, in the consolidation figures in the market survey, the original ones, the ones that were given to the governor, wasn't the figure, this is from Lisa Rudd to the governor on the original needs assessment and talking about the, was the figure $3 a square foot for Fairbanks?
Could you restate the question? I'm sorry.
It was a consolidation figure. And when the governor asked for consolidation figures and what the cost would be and the estimate, and Lisa Rudd provided him with this needs assessment base and how many feet they would need and the rest of it, was there a figure in there that allowed for $3 a square foot for Fairbanks?
That's, I think you're referring to the information from the December 1st memo of 83.
Right. Yes. But it said $3 a square foot Fairbanks.
Yes.
But the bid eventually went for $239.
The negotiations went for $239.
The price was $239. Now, could you have done a 239 figure if it would have been a lease purchase? Or was that what the $3 was predicated on, lease purchase?
No, I don't think it was necessarily predicated upon that. And the question there is, the only way you'd be able to determine that would have been to go out with a bid. Because you can structure a lease purchase arrangement practically any way you want to. And so
that didn't have anything to do with it, with the new building or anything like that. Didn't have anything to do with the $3 bid.
The $3 per square foot was just an average estimate. And you can, but you were also referring to the part about lease purchase, and you could construct that any way you'd want to.
Well, the reason that I ask you about the lease purchase, because there was a possibility it could be a new building, right?
Yes.
Well, that was why, what I meant it to, rather than, and whether the new building would really cost more on a lease purchase arrangement than just an ordinary 10-year lease.
It is possible that a new building could cost less than, which happened here in Juneau once, than an existing lease.
Are you a controversial figure? Do you
I really don't want to be.
No, are you? Do you consider yourself as one? Have you ever appeared in newspapers and been classified as questionable in certain areas? And certainly your activities as a leasing officer for the state.
Well,
been a subject of bad newspaper notoriety.
I think that there have been some articles in some newspapers throughout the state in a large city that have taken some shots at me.
Understand why. Tremendous personality. What was the difference between the sole source negotiations in the Fifth Avenue and in the Resolution Towers in Anchorage? Is there any difference in that?
I don't specifically remember. You know, have remembrances of the Resolution Tower case. I think I don't have any specific recollection.
Did you approve of the Resolution Towers text?
Senator Ray, I may have.
Now, you've told us that you've done 95%. Was this one of the 5% that you didn't do?
I don't know whether I did or didn't. It would not surprise me if that came. I'm talking about a specific memory of having done that.
Did the AG's office write the specs for that or give you the information on how they wanted that sole source bid written?
I think as you're discussing about this, that did have to do with space for the Attorney General's office. But I would like to remind or bring up the point about the fact that at least during an average week, I probably wind up signing up on limited solicitations, sole sources, and items of that.
A different way. You do know that the Resolution Towers was a sole source contract. And it goes to the Department of Law, right?
I don't have a specific. I'm saying it might have been. If you will allow me to pull out the document, I'll be glad to look at it.
How many sole source do you sign off every week?
I would say probably on an average, I know that if you take a look at professional services, contracting, and so forth, they may average up to 5 to 10 a week.
There really isn't anything strange about a sole source contract.
No, there are many different branches and versions. A lot of those have to do, since the law is very strict as to how it looks at it, any renewal of an existing contract is also a sole source determination.
You don't have anything in your memory, though, that would bring the Resolution Towers to your mind.
No, I didn't say that, Senator Ray. I said that there is, as you are talking here, I do have some vague memory of
that. What brings it to your mind? Could you tell us what it was, the Attorney General's?
Once you said Attorney General.
Now that I brought it
but
back.
I think I had already previously mentioned that there were some other sole source space acquisitions.
Did you check with them as to the legality of the Resolution Towers contract? Do you get upset or any of your people because of what
Senator Ray, you ask questions and you don't allow the witness time to finish. If you could kind of give him a little time to finish the answer to the previous question, sir.
Well, I was
I'm easy. I don't specifically remember checking out Resolution Towers with them. I figured they must pretty well know what they wanted to do. And I believe
if anything the AG's office says and the sole source is okay with you?
No, not necessarily. In fact, Mr. Hickey and I had quite a, we had some discussion over the sole source that he wanted, a very slight one, that he wanted up in Barrel. In fact, we had some discussion back and forth as to whether or not that particular one was appropriate.
Did you keep a file on this like you did on the governor?
Fairbanks? I think, Senator Ray, that you would have to let me characterize it this way. If you take a look at the documentation on the Fairbanks case, you'll find it about this high. If you look at the Frontier building, which is about 150,000 square feet, it's about this big. If you take a look at some of those others, they're about that big. But you'll find that the documentation in this particular case exceeds practically anything to my known memory.
Why were the occupancy dates considered as unusual in the original competitive bid on the 5th Avenue building? This is the July 1st to January 1st date.
I don't think we considered a sliding scale occupancy unusual. I mean, it was unusual from the degree that normally we just ask for a date. But we were in, this is, first of all, the largest, I think, single block of space, to my memory, that we were trying to acquire in Fairbanks. We hadn't done that before. I think, on average, we spend about $1 million a year or something like that for leases in Fairbanks, and we spend about $10 million a year in Anchorage, and the rest of it spread throughout elsewhere. So, therefore, this was a very large acquisition for us compared to normal. And also, my understanding was that since we had several ways we could perform that move, and we had a leapfrog type of move that we could do very simply from the Fairbanks Regional Office Building to any new lease space, that using a flexibility would give us a chance to get a better price.
Well, to the uninitiated, wouldn't this kind of look like you were bureaucratically tinkering with things rather than going with the usual frame of stuff?
Well, I think that we will, our job
Mr.
is...
Stack. Could we ask you to pause for a minute, please? The stenographer has run out of tape, and the Rules Committee will take a 10-minute recess at this time. Order, please. Senator Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Stack, I think we were talking about the unusual connotation of the competitive bid arrangement. Can you identify any other RFPs previous to that date that had the flexible time?
Senator, I don't really have a specific recollection of a previous RFP that may have had that. They may have had that. I would like to make one statement, though, and I think just in general, and that is from the last meeting. And I do this as a matter of course because I've testified before committees for a long time. I did not mean to turn this into a circus or anything else like that. So, Senator Ray, I probably owe you a part of an apology.
Oh, I don't mind.
Yes, please.
Then, would you say, from your memory and from your experience, that there usually is only one date, such as occupancy date of July 1st or January 10th or whatever it comes down?
Usually, the way I've often perceived it is that you usually only have one date, but I think, you know, there may have been other instances, but I'm really not that familiar with, you know, whether or not, because we've got in excess of 400 leases that we work on right now. And keeping, I think it's the numbers closer to around 435 leases. And they're in, got to be close to more than about 120 some odd locations throughout the state. There's some small ones, big ones, and whatever. However that works out, some of them are part. And we're in constant renegotiation. In fact, our leasing numbers probably change daily, monthly, whatever. So it's not that that couldn't be there. It's just that I think in some of the major ones that we've done in the past, we have more fixed dates. Now, we did have some flexibility. We have some definite flexibility in terms of what we did in the Frontier building, in terms of when we would take space, move in, move out, and so forth.
How did the governor get the original RFP?
I don't know how the governor got you the RFP.
That's one that was described by Mr. Shively with his initial one. You don't know how the governor got that?
I only passed on a copy of the RFP, to my knowledge. I handed it I think the note that I made was that I had transmitted a copy of the RFP to Lynn Bartlett, who was the governor's secretary. At the time.
You did?
As I remember, yes. That's what my note states, that I handed it to Lynn Bartlett.
And you approve all RFPs and all that before they go out of your office?
No, I don't approve them all. We have a whole lot of RFPs before they go out. I have a regular staff, general services and supply, you know, puts out a lot of RFPs. And I don't specifically approve all of them. Those are all processed by the divisions. We must put out between 50 and 100 bids or more a year, a lot more than that. And I basically let that up to the division director and his people.
Well, something was made out of, I believe, by somebody that asked Mr. Shively if he approved of the RFP, and he said he didn't read it either. I remember when he said he didn't read it either? I was just thinking, well, neither one of you read it, apparently. You testified that you did not give the RFP, or whatever it is, to Lori Herman?
I do not have a recollection of that. I remember that Lori Herman and I had discussions about contents of the RFP, but I do not remember giving her a copy of the RFP.
And you can't imagine how she remembered it and you didn't?
I'm not going to speculate on that.
I mean, it wasn't important. It wouldn't be important in your mind to give her an RFP or not. It wasn't anything that would stand out in your memory as being not the proper thing to do.
No, I have stated previously that I believe that any official above myself has a right to have a copy of an RFP.
Mm-hmm.
And also a draft one if they so choose to have one.
Yeah, well, I'm not questioning your integrity. I'm just saying it wasn't really that important to you. In the stage of who you're giving it to.
No.
Well, to try to analyze this whole thing, in essence, wasn't your office really in complete control of whether the sole source lease could be successfully negotiated? Weren't you really in charge, your outfit?
Senator, we have been given directions, as far as I was concerned, as to the constraints that were to be placed on this particular negotiation. We had provided information as to what we thought we needed. We provided information as to what we thought the occupancy dates ought to be and how that should be conducted, a rather weighty document. We got a response back that indicated that there was a desired change in terms of both occupancy time and the area to be used. So therefore, we changed and molded to those constraints. Those constraints were established or initially passed on to us by others above us. And we proceeded from that time. Now, we did conduct the negotiations. And we were, the people in my area conducted those negotiations and came to the final price.
You could have refused the owner's offer no matter what it was, though, couldn't you? Sole source.
We could have refused the owner's offer if we believed it was totally out of line.
But it was legitimate. Commissioner Rudd signed it. Did she have a problem signing it? I mean, did you and her talk about it? And she said, gee, I hate to sign this thing, but I guess I'm going to have to.
I don't think she had any particular problem. We had the backup information. We had discussed all of the things. We had the summary memoranda to proceed with the project, and it was on those basis. But then, of course, that was all based upon the original criteria established.
Well, in your mind, knowing your people, wouldn't they have refused to negotiate if they thought that that action was illegal?
I have to answer that question in terms of whether or not they believed that there might be actions taken against them if they didn't. My belief was that if they had a serious concern that that was in fact illegal, and now remember, none of us, to my knowledge, either myself, Mr. Link, Mr. Moore, Mr. Peterson, and Mr. Jackson are attorneys. And therefore, you know, sometimes when we use the word something's legal, we don't have the ability to correctly characterize that. but I believe that if they felt that they were doing something totally wrong, that they could refuse to do that and state, you know, the reasons for that. I have overridden turn down of where the staff recommended, to my memory in the past, I have overridden where the staff said we shouldn't go ahead with this sole source, and I have overridden that. And they made a written determination that they felt that it was not appropriate to do that, and I made a written determination that it was. And that's entirely appropriate. That incident sticks in my mind at that particular point in time, and that's entirely appropriate. The staff should write down what they believe, and I don't believe that I have a right or anybody has a right to, you know, that I shouldn't ask them to be willing to sign off to it if I'm not willing to sign off to it. And they have a right to write down what they believe is right, wrong, or indifferent. And I can remember one incident. I can't remember the specific case, but I can remember in my memory that, and this was on a professional services contract, it wasn't a commodity one, where I overrode the contract review committee. And I made my notations known. And that was entirely appropriate. And each of those individuals who were on the contract review committee, I think at the time, there were some classified people on that committee, and that was that.
Well, from the testimony, and if I could, you kind of went a little afield there, and I was thinking of something else, but from the testimony that's been given, that some of your people were so fearful that they were doing something wrong, they went and contacted private attorneys, and they did go to the Attorney General's office and talk to Mr. Rubini and Mr. Baldwin.
I think that I really think this is a very important point. Because I think when you talk in terms of pressure of what people have, you cannot, and I will continue to repeat this point, you cannot isolate this situation from the other things that were going on simultaneously. You can't, in terms of the level of responsibility that these people had. And to briefly review that, there are 5 projects going on simultaneously at this time. We were being kicked out of the Marine View in June of 1984, as to my memory was. That's 34,000 square feet. Involved moving 5 sections of various departments.